Welcome to the Women in Sport and Exercise Academic Network podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jackie Forsyth, and also co-founder of the network. The purpose of the Women in Sport and Exercise Academic Network is to grow, strengthen, and promote research on women in sport and exercise, with the ultimate goal of optimising women's athletic success and their participation. At Solent University, Dr. Philippa Velia is head of school and also an associate professor in the sociology of sport. Philippa's research is focused on a sociological analysis of women's experience in a range of sport, leisure and educational settings. She is author of Women's Cricket and Global Processes and co-editor of Figurational Research in Sport, Leisure and Health. Her latest book, Gender Equity in UK Sport Leadership, was discussed in this podcast, as well as Philippa's previous research on cricket. Because of Philippa's successful career in senior management, we talked about her journey, her advice to others, as well as her current and future research plans.
Hi, Philippa. Welcome to our podcast for the Women in Sport and Exercise Academic Network. But if it's okay, can we start talking about this book that's about to be released that's called Gender Equity in UK Sport Governance? Can you tell me a bit about why you wrote that book and an overview of the content?
Yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, thanks for having me and inviting me to do this. It's really a great opportunity, so really appreciate that. So the book is called Gender Equity in UK Sport Governance. It's co-edited with Lucy Piggott, who I think has also been on your podcast before, talking about her research on gender and leadership. And it's part of the Emerald Studies in Sport and Gender series. So it sits nicely within a sort of body of work around sort of sport and gender. And really, the book emerged out of my own interest in terms of research into sport and mergers between male and female sports organisations. And then I'd also been doing some work around the sort of gender pay gap. And it struck me when I was sort of doing that work that there's this sort of growing discourse that, you know, women's sport has come so far, you know, the professionalisation of women's sport, which is all excellent and there has been huge improvements. But I think there are still gaps, and one of those gaps is definitely the number of women in leadership and sort of governance or positions of sort of decision making in sport. So really, Lucy, I met Lucy a couple of years ago at a conference. You know, I was aware of her work and I really wanted to work with somebody else on this project, just because I find certainly, and I'll talk about this a bit later, that, you know, at the moment with the pressures that we're on in academia, I think it's good to work with other people. So, you know, I'd met Lucy, we got on well, we had similar ideas and interests. So we put our heads together and said, you know, what are some of the key themes? So really the book has sort of three parts. And the first is an overview of strategy, policy and structure in terms of UK sport governance and gender. But one of the unique aspects of that is that we break down the sort of home nations. So we've got England, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales to look at, because obviously there are similarities in terms of the structures and the sort of policies that they've put in place around gender, but there are differences as well. So we wanted to sort of bring that out. And then the second part of the section is more on people's sort of empirical research and their insight from those who've been doing research in the area of sort of gender leadership and governance. And that really brings out, I guess, some of the everyday issues that women are still facing when they work in the sports sector. So that's a sort of brief summary of the sort of text. And we've got some excellent sort of contributors across the sort of field bringing quite contemporary research to that area.
Excellent. Thanks for that summary. I think you say that it's a timely analysis of structure and policy in the UK. Why do you think it's needed at this particular time?
I think from our perspective, when you look at some of the changes around sort of policy in gender, so if you look at things like quotas and the drive to have more women on sort of board level, so I think there has been quite a lot of traction in terms of trying to have more women represented at particular levels in terms of sport governance and leadership. But having said that, you know, that there is still a long way to go. So I think what we were sort of interested in, well, what has been done, you know, what's the impact of that been? And then where do we sort of go from here in terms of looking at some of the research around particularly improving the sort of culture, I think, in sports organisations for women, and looking at that sort of everyday experience of what's it actually like working in some of these organisations and spaces.
When you say there's a long way to go, do you think then there will be any change in the future? Do you think that women's sport in this context will always be in the shadow of men's sport, or do you think there will be some change?
So, I mean, I think it's a process. You know, so my background is sort of sociology, and I often look at sort of long-term processes. So I think if you look sort of historically and you look at the sort of development of sort of women's sport and then women working in the sports sector, which is what this particular sort of book looks at, I think that there has been improvements and there has been change. And I think there will continue to be change. I think there are the two things. There are quite big differences across different organisations. So in my chapter, I look at sort of gender pay gap data, where it's available, which is only available in certain organisations. So it's not a perfect analysis. But if you look at that, the gender pay gap is very, very marked in professional sports organisations, and particularly sort of football, rugby, and actually something like the ECB cricket as well. So I think there are differences across different types of sports and different organisations. I think some of the policy around women being on the board and having more, you know, that is linked to sort of funding has made a difference. But I think we need to be mindful that it's not just at board level that, you know, are there enough women working in the organisation sector that can then develop up into board level? So we don't just look at that sort of top level. Also about the sort of women working in the sports sector and organisations more broadly. And is there opportunities for sort of leadership and development in the sector rather than bringing people from other parts of the sector but who have, you know, expertise? Are we doing enough to develop those women who want to develop a career in sort of the sport organisation sector?
And can you do more?
So I think, I mean, some of the chapters in the book, so there's, you know, some really excellent research from our contributors. And one of those looks around sort of the idea of sort of authentic leadership and how we might develop more authentic leaders in the sports sector and what influence that might have in terms of challenging some of the gendered cultures in sport. I think there is more to be done around sort of challenging what might be perceived as quite negative behaviours around sort of banter, bullying, harassment in the workplace. So that cultural aspect, because with the policy is one thing, the policy might drive some change. But I think, you know, from our perspective, looking at some of the, you know, cultures in those organisations, how you sort of challenge those behaviours and attitudes, I think it is something that needs more work.
And you talked about different sporting organisations, and I know you've focused on specific sports in the past when you've done research. So for instance, you've looked at cricket or you've looked at horse riding. Did you look at those sports specifically because there was this gender disparity?
Yeah, so I mean, when I was a sort of student, I was interested in sort of sport, gender and sociology. And so I was trying to combine my sort of interests into thinking about sort of research. And I was also an avid cricket fan. So I realised, I knew very little about the game, although I'd grown up watching cricket. I'd never played cricket actually, because I attended an all-girls school and cricket was not one of the things that was accepted. So, you know, I came to it thinking about, you know, why did I know so much about sort of men's cricket? And I knew nothing about the women's game. So that really sparked an interest in me. And so I did my master's thesis on the sort of development of women's cricket and then went on to do my PhD in that area. And at the time, there was very little known about the sort of women's game. So for me, it was about trying to make visible in the academic sense, the sort of development of women's cricket. And, you know, it had been played and organised by women. You know, I think the first recorded women's match is 1745, and the Women's Cricket Association developed in 1926. You know, and these women ran and developed the game. They played internationally, globally, and my latter work really looked at the development of women's cricket in Sri Lanka and India and Pakistan as well. And I was really interested in sort of understanding how the women's game developed in different political and social contexts.
So did you have any interest from any of the cricket boards, like the English Cricket Board at all, based on your work?
No. And I think at the time I probably didn't sort of pursue that. I mean, a lot of my research sort of looked at trying to understand the sort of development and emergence of the sort of game historically, but also more recent history. So around the sort of mergers. So I've written about sort of merger of the Women's Cricket Association and the ECB. And I was lucky enough to interview a lot of the women who had been involved as part of the Women's Cricket Association. And I think there has been some improvements, but I think from the ECB's perspective, that's kind of like a hidden, like a gone, it's gone, that was the history, now it's sort of moving forward. But I think without understanding the sort of history and how the game's developed in particular ways and the relationship between sort of cricket, men and masculinity, you can't really fully understand the position of sort of women's cricket now, because the way it came about and the sort of power differences in the game and the different structures, the different supports in the game, from a sociological perspective, you can't really understand that sort of present day without trying to understand how it came to be. So, no, I guess in short, I haven't had many discussions with the ECB.
Is there any other sport that doesn't follow this model of having maybe a real increase in sport for women at the beginning of the 20th century, and then this dropout? Is there any sport that's evolved just as a women's sport that you can specifically look at as a good practice or a model that could be used?
Yeah, I mean, I guess netball would be the example of that, as sort of being a women's, you know, generally viewed as sort of women's only sport, although more and more men are now playing netball. And they have been sort of challenging, I guess, the sort of separate philosophy of the women's, and particularly internationally at women's level, netball. They've been quite clear that it's a women's game and it's for women. So there has been some challenges to that. But netball is interesting because of its position as being a female-only sport. It hasn't had, I guess, the same investment development. It's not an Olympic sport. So there are examples of sort of women's only sports, but it's difficult to draw comparisons, I think, because haven't necessarily had the same level of sort of support and development if there had been a male version of that sport, ironically.
And does the future look any brighter? Is there anything that could be done?
I mean, I think that we're now in a process of professionalisation of women's sport. I think we are, you know, in that process, and I think that will continue to develop. I think there's a lot more understanding about how to market sort of women's sport. I think there is an acceptance now that people are interested. You know, there is still a sort of belief that people wouldn't necessarily pay to watch women's sport. There isn't that interest. Whereas I think, you know, there is a growing recognition that there is interest in watching women play sport. There is a professional marketing interest, but I think there is more work to do in terms of how those sports can be sort of developed to continue on that sort of path, because there is some research and You know, I haven't done any research in this area, but there is research to suggest that sort of COVID-19, the pandemic, particularly impacted sort of women's sport, the income of women's sport and women being able to play sport professionally. So, you know, it's not necessarily always a linear process either, because there are, you know, factors that, you know, influence and might put that process. You know, it's a fluid rather than a sort of linear process. And I think some sports are more committed to that agenda than others.
And for yourself, because you developed in terms of your senior leadership and management position within sport initially, but then in a wider field, have you encountered any gender discrimination? Maybe I shouldn't ask that in such a negative way, as though I assume that you have, but have you come across anything within your career that's, you know, some kind of gender discrimination?
Yes, and certainly when I look back on that, I think I'm able to articulate that better than at the time that I might have been experienced those situations. I mean, certainly just studying women's sport in itself, I think, would spark lots of discussions. I mean, when you're researching anything, there's lots of discussions about why would you research that. But certainly at the time, I mean, I started my sort of PhD, you know, 2002, it would have been 2003, you know, the focus on sort of women's sport, there was an idea, it was, you know, just feminist scholars that were interested in sort of women's sport. There wasn't the same body of interest, I think, even certainly across the sport disciplines. There wasn't sociology, but across the sports disciplines, there certainly wasn't. So there was always that sort of need to sort of, well, what's the point in studying women's cricket? You know, why would you bother sort of even analysis? So there was that sort of, I guess, what I'd call sort of microaggressions around what's the point of studying sort of women's sport. When I finished my PhD, I went into a nearly all male sports department. And I think that with mainly male students, and certainly across my experiences, there were, you know, hostilities. And the fact that I was teaching gender and I was teaching, you know, about gender and women's sport, you know, the sort of perception, oh, well, she's a woman, of course she's going to say that, but, you know, we haven't experienced that, so we don't think it's an issue. So I think, yeah, there's certainly been experiences where I don't think my work has been valued because you're perhaps studying sort of women's sport. And then also I think the challenges of being in quite a male-dominated space.
And what about advice for other women who might want to progress their careers in terms of management? Is there anything that could make their journey a little bit more, a little easier, a little more comfortable? What would you say?
I mean, I would always say to find, you know, mentors and support networks. I mean, that has been a lifeline to me throughout my career, to have, like, you know, a small number of people who, you know, I can trust and rely on for sort of support, advice and empathy, I think, in terms of, you know, that other people will have experienced, you know, challenges, whether that's relation in terms of gender. But certainly as your career develops and you go into management and leadership, It's a really challenging environment, and I think you need good people to be able to offer you that sort of support and networks. And sometimes those people might be more senior than you, but also peer networks. And, you know, I think I've just been really fortunate that I've had some incredible people to sort of support me and sort of pick me up at times where it's been particularly difficult. And I think, you know, now I'm in my role, I think it's important. I mentor people and sort of support people as well. So I think also when you're here, there is an aspect of sort of responsibility in terms of, you know, supporting, encouraging and mentoring other colleagues.
That's really good advice. It's almost like having somebody to have your back, really. And also for you, you're still doing research, even though you've got this big role in terms of senior management. I don't know how you fit them both in, but anyway, have you got any plans for the future in terms of your research?
Yeah, so I'm working on two quite exciting projects at the moment, sort of, but both early days, but both sort of related to my previous interests. But in the last couple of years, I've been looking in particular at sort of lad cultures and sort of lad cultures, HE environments, but particularly around sort of those studying sports science. And I've just got a small pot of funding to do some work with some colleagues looking at bystander training and bystander workshops to try and to give people the sort of skills to be able to challenge harassment, abuse and particular types of cultures that we might see in our sort of classrooms and HE spaces. So, I mean, bystander workshops, bystander training are very well established now. And I'm lucky enough to have some colleagues who've done some work around this and have delivered this as well. So we're really interested in bringing that to sort of Solent in the first instance to look at whether we can sort of empower young people and colleagues to sort of challenge using quite established techniques, aspects around sort of lad culture, harassment and changing the culture, which links to the sort of changing the culture report that was produced in terms of higher education cultures. So that's one aspect. And then I've been lucky enough to work with somebody that I used to work with previously, another institution, and we're looking at sort of preschool children and physical activity and commercialised sort of toddler groups, looking at sort of the growth and demand for toddler commercialised activities and what's the sort of motivation and benefit and for parents in terms of committing what is quite a lot of economic capital to these particular things like diddy kicks, soccer kicks, baby ballet. You know, what's the real motivations and purpose to these sorts of activities for young people?
Well, that all sounds really interesting, particularly interested in the lad culture thing and the bystander workshops. Those workshops, what is the key message in them?
So the key message of the bystander workshops is to identify that bystander. So you might witness, I don't know, somebody making a comment in a classroom, you know, so it might be an inappropriate comment about another student, or, you know, look what she's wearing, or, you know, and you give the bystander the techniques to be able to challenge that comment. Or actually the challenge can just be not laughing, not passing the comment, or not encouraging the comment. It doesn't always have to be confrontational. There are ways of signalling that language or that comment is not acceptable without having to always directly challenge. So the idea of bystander is that you give people the skills to be able to sort of challenge particular types of comments in either direct or non-direct ways, either at the time or after the event. So it's really about giving people the sort of skills. Well, first of all, the first part of bystander is actually people being able to identify why those comments are inappropriate. Then what can they do about those? So you move to, I guess, starting to shift some of the cultures, because there might be a belief that, you know, you're the only one that thinks those comments are unacceptable. But actually the evidence suggests that most people would think that those comments are unacceptable. It's just nobody necessarily sort of speaks up and challenges. So it's, like I say, it's a really well-established sort of programme that has been developed by lots of sort of universities in different ways. And it's just a way that you can start to develop and challenge some of the things that people might be seeing and quite gendered, particularly sort of lad cultures that you might see in particular spaces.
That sounds great, I love that. So really interested in hearing about the research on that for the future. Thanks ever so much, Philippa, for doing this podcast with me. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
No, thanks again for inviting me.